I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Last week, after a tearful debate in Annapolis, delegates in the Maryland General Assembly passed a bill that would allow physicians to prescribe drugs to their terminally ill patients that would give those patients the option of ending their lives. 7 other states have similar laws. A recent Goucher College poll indicated that 6 out of 10 Marylanders favor giving dying patients choice when faced with a terminal illness. Today, a conversation around the ethical issues of so-called aid in dying laws for patients, doctors, and society. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Dr. Mark Comrade is a psychiatrist and the ethicist in residence at the Shepherd Pratt Health System. They join me for this installment of Midday on Ethics right after the news. Good afternoon. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday today. Today, it's Midday on Ethics. Last Thursday, the Maryland House of Delegates passed a bill that would allow terminally ill patients with a prognosis of less than 6 months to live to obtain prescription drugs that they could choose to take to end their own lives. A Senate committee is now considering it. Similar bills have stalled in the General Assembly for the past several years. In a few minutes, Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics will join us. But first, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Mark Comrade back to the show. He's a psychiatrist on the faculty of Johns Hopkins, the University of Maryland, and Tulane University. He's also the ethicist in residence for the Shepherd Pratt Health Systems. He's on the line from his office here in Baltimore. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation about the so-called aid in dying legislation, 410-662-8780, that's our phone number, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We've already gotten a number of emails from folks that we'll get to at some point in the program. But Mark Comrade, you oppose so-called physician-assisted suicide. Why is that?
I'm very much appreciative of your giving me an opportunity, especially to start off with this oppositional voice. You know, Tom, I'm both a practicing clinician as a psychiatrist and have spent 35 years as a medical ethicist. So I've really taken a very deep dive into this issue from both points of departure and really have come to some very well-developed concerns about why we shouldn't have these laws. As a matter of fact, these laws have come up 247 times in the various legislatures around America and have been voted down all but 8 times, and now, of course, we're on the verge of it here in Maryland. So there are important reasons, both in terms of why this is bad public policy, as well as why this is not good medical ethics. And I'd like to go through, you know, briefly some 10 reasons why I've put together why this is not a good idea. First is, I think that laws like this that designate one group of people for whom suicide is acceptable while simultaneously trying to promulgate a public health message to prevent suicide in other people is very, very difficult. And where you draw the line to say arbitrarily that people in this particular category, which is terminal illness, should have an opportunity to do this is in a very arbitrary place. First of all, what constitutes a terminal illness is not particularly clinically reliable. And secondly, issues of justice and fairness, which become just as important as self-determination and the right of choice, then begin to erode that line so that those who stand slightly outside of the line start to say, well, how come not us, if you give it to them and not us? And it certainly does send a very mixed message that suicide is acceptable for some people, but not other people.
And let me interrupt for a second. The people who would say, why not us, are, for example, who?
Well, people who have, say, 7 months to live. Again, that's not particularly reliable. Or people who have chronic deteriorating illnesses for which no other solutions are there. You know, in Europe, we've seen in the living laboratories of Belgium and Netherlands, We've actually seen them remove any distinctions between a terminal and a non-terminal on the basis of justice and fairness, and also saying that physical suffering and mental suffering really shouldn't be distinguished. As a matter of fact, a message we psychiatrists have actually been trying to promote for years, and therefore, once you efface those two, people in those countries in Europe are now eligible if they have a mental disorder, if they have a chronic psychiatric illness, if they have chronic debilitating illnesses like multiple sclerosis or ALS. It's very, very difficult. No country that has been experimenting with this for a while has truly been able to hold it to just the terminally ill. And indeed, now even in Oregon, there's a bill afoot to try to expand the eligibility because, again, principles of fairness and justice make it go in that direction.
Yeah, but
and
again, but let's
slippery
be,
slope ensues.
But let's be clear to our listeners that the bill that's being considered by the Maryland legislature is for terminally ill patients with who've been diagnosed with six or fewer months to live.
So, But
you're saying this is a slippery slope, you're saying.
Yeah, that's the way that it starts, and no country has been able to hold it there. Even Canada has gotten rid of the terminally ill diagnoses. Again, it always starts that way. That's mm-hmm. the way it begins. And then it begins to, again, with the same principles that are dear to democratic societies, fairness and justice and parity. Once the horse is out of the barn, it's almost impossible to keep it strained to further pastures. Now, the second thing is that the implications of a law like this is that there actually are lives not worth living, that debilitation, dependency are simply things that we need to acknowledge might not be lives worth living. And frankly, the disability community is particularly up in arms about these kinds of laws because they feel that it telegraphs a message that really degrades the disabled, and that as a result, that fulcrum between what's an acceptable life and an unacceptable life becomes moved. And that's one of the messages that are telegraphed by this law. Also, these laws, like ours, as well as the other seven jurisdictions, really do not have adequate safeguards to be able to distinguish between the issue of being helpful and encouraging if you're a supportive relative and coercion. There's no mechanism to monitor whether or not there's coercion afoot, no way to figure out whether those who are supporters and encouragers might also be beneficiaries of the person's death, no way to assess that or monitor, and no statutory definitions as to how to tell the nuanced differences between grandma, you know, you can do this, you can take your, and it's hundreds of pills, by the way, your box of barbiturates, and grandma, you know, you promised to take it, you know, it's been another day since you've gotten those pills have been in your closet, and, you know, you really should go ahead and do this. So the nuanced differences between coercion and encouragement are not adequate.
Okay, and I should mention to listen. Let me just mention this: is that we're going to give Dr. Comrade a chance to state the case and to give his reasons, and then we will respond to some of these things after a break. But you know, because there are safeguards according to the folks who've written the bill. You know, they may not be adequate, but we'll talk about what those are a little bit later. We want to make sure that in the limited time we have, that you have a chance to
make the safeguards are entirely inadequate. Mm-hmm. Also, there's no tracking the medication at all. Nothing to prevent your suicidal granddaughter, God forbid, from getting the box of barbiturates that you've stuffed away in the closet to take at the time and place of your own choosing. There's nothing to divert them, to call them back, to monitor them, and to make sure that nobody who shouldn't get their hands on them gets their hands on them. The fact is that when you outsource suicide to the medical establishment, you're actually removing a very important taboo. We in psychiatry deal with suicide all the time, and as a matter of fact, you know, our core ethos is actually to prevent suicide, not to provide it, as is being done by these laws. But an important part of suicide prevention, although we certainly don't want stigma against those who've suicided, is a certain taboo against that. And by saying, okay, I absolve myself of responsibility for taking my life, I now give it, put it in the hands of a doctor to prescribe me a chemical gun with which I can shoot myself, which is essentially really what this is. Or in those countries that have euthanasia, where I can go to the doctor, he can start an IV and shoot me himself with a chemical gun, removes a very important taboo against suicide that, again, moves that fulcrum between acceptable and unacceptable suicide. And these laws basically shift suicide from being what it is now, a freedom. Certainly people are free to attempt that, although I certainly hope they come knocking on my door first in as an option before they do that, because we have the resources to help them, especially in psychiatry. But these laws shift suicide from being a freedom to being a right. And when something is a right, when a government stands up something as a right, it has a duty to provide the means for administering that right. So we have a right to vote. The government has to provide us voting machines. So by turning to medicine, they are introducing into medicine a duty, not necessarily that you have to do this, but it is now on physicians to deploy that new right. And the fact is that assisted suicide and euthanasia have actually been very explicitly considered unethical in the House of Medicine since its origins. As a matter of fact, the origins of medicine and the cult of Hippocrates back in ancient Greece, that was the one place in Greece that you could go where they promised they did not perform euthanasia. They did not take a life. And in fact, you had to subscribe to a covenantal community. You had to take an oath.
The Hippocratic Oath, right.
The Hippocratic Oath.
So, Mark, I need to ask you to finish up your point. We have a ton of callers and a lot of some are under a time constraint. So
let
your final
point
then.
The Hippocratic Oath says, I will not give a poison to any other man, nor counsel anyone how to do so. That has been the root out of which the mighty tree of medicine has grown and the House of Medicine has been built. Killing does not belong in the House of Medicine. We can ameliorate suffering. We can actually even help people find meaning with suffering. We can help people find a path to a better future. And the state of the art of palliative care, which is the real death with dignity, is often not as readily available to people as it should be, not as funded to people as it should be, but helping people to die with comfort and caring is what physicians do, not providing killing.
Dr. Mark Conrad is a psychiatrist on the faculty of Johns Hopkins, the University of Maryland, and Tulane University, as well as the ethicist in residence for the Shepherd Pratt Health Systems. He's the author of You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Get Counseling. And one quick point, Mark, before we go, and I'm already over time here, but we have one caller wondering, is any of your opposition to this legislation and legislation like it based in religious practice? Or is this, are you speaking from the point of view as a medical professional?
Yeah, my own particular point of view is as a medical professional. Although, you know, surely in a secular society, we've replaced religious values like the sanctity of life with humanist values like autonomy and self-determination. The fact of the matter is that the ethics of medicine, and contemporarily, the World Medical Association, the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, a number of world bodies continue to maintain in the legacy of Hippocrates, this is not an ethical practice.
All right. Well, Mark Conrad, I very much appreciate your time and your perspective and appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
It's midday on Ethics. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more on the ethics of end-of-life choices with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We already have a number of callers in line in the queue. We will get to as many of you as we can. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @midday_WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our program tomorrow, it's Midday on Theater. Stephanie Ibarra is the new artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage. She'll join me and Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick, and we'll talk about plans for Center Stage next season and beyond. Plus, Judy will review the new production of Flyin' West at Baltimore's Arena Player. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Ethics. We're talking about the ethics of assisted suicide, as some people call it, or choice at the end of life, as others refer to it. The House of Delegates in Annapolis passed a bill last week that would make it legal for doctors to prescribe life-ending drugs for patients that the patients may choose to take if they are older than 18 and if they have a terminal illness with a life expectancy of less than 6 months. The state Senate is now considering the measure. We turn now to Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation, we've gotten a number of emails and a number of callers, but we'll do our best to get to folks. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. I want to start first with the rhetoric around this issue. I've used the term in the promo for this show today of medically assisted suicide, because that's what a lot of folks in Annapolis are calling it. And I got a very thoughtful email from a guy named Nick Sheraton, who says the issue is not about suicide, and the term is disrespectful to the patients who already have a terminal disease that will kill them within 6 months and may choose to avoid the incurable pain that may go with it. It's about choice in dying, or choice at the end of life, and either of those would be better terms for what the current bill in Annapolis seeks to allow.
And I was struck in the first part of the show with Mark Conrad's continued use of the term suicide, which of course sets it up as a particular kind of argument. And the bill, as you point out, is called the End of Life Option Act. It doesn't say the Medically Assisted Suicide Act. So I think the language matters. I'm actually more inclined to agree with the email that you read as the right way to think about what's being proposed in legislation like what's been passed by the House of Delegates here in Maryland. And I would even maybe say it a little bit differently, that it's about control of the end of one's life. Because if we're to endorse the idea of 6 months or less left in one's life, that it's really about how you control those last 6 months. That's a different, I think, in most people's minds than the notion of suicide. Right. Ending your life may be technically suicide, but it's sort of a different idea than controlling how you die when you only have a limited time left to live.
And so it would, however, be suicide in that the bill allows for a doctor to prescribe drugs to the patient, and then the patient decides whether or not to take those drugs. The patient has to be 18 years old or older, have a terminal illness with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, and the patient must request the prescription on three different occasions. Mm-hmm. So one is in private, once in writing, and these are provisions meant to guard against one of the things that Dr. Conrad mentioned, the coercion possibility. And there are even waiting periods and the ability, of course, to rescind the request at any time. So the legislature has considered these things. But if you take a pill knowing that it's going to kill you, that is suicide.
As I said, technically, definitionally, probably yes. Mm-hmm. But I think the way that most people think about suicide, and I think the way Mark was actually talking about helping people lead fulfilling lives when they think they want to die, is a kind of presumption that they have prospects that are different than the last 6 months of their life. So the words may be technically correct, but I don't know that the meaning is really as we typically understand it in the common usages of those terms. And I should say before we continue, I'm not an advocate of aid in dying. That's not why I'm sitting here and talking with you and the listeners. I've also thought a lot about these issues, and I think I have a pretty good handle on the ethical issues and the policy issues around this debate. So I'm happy to engage in the sort of discussion and analysis without trying to advocate either way, although it's now been a kind of litany of the things that are problematic. And so we may end up in a kind of back and forth about what's wrong with each of those arguments.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from Norma who says the main thing that people with terminal illness don't have is control. And Jeff, this is to your point. Norma goes on to say, if having an extra choice at the end of life can provide some well-thought-out peace of mind, why shouldn't that be available? The choice is available to 1 in 5 Americans, but not to residents of Maryland. If this type of choice doesn't appeal to you, it's a no-brainer. Don't take it.
Yeah.
It may not be a no-brainer.
Well, but I think it goes to among the things that we heard earlier in the show. So I would say that laws like this one, and there are states in, mostly in the western part of our country that have policy, have created rights, but they're negative rights. They're not rights that must be provided. They're rights to get out of the way of people exercising what they take to be control of their lives at the end of their lives. That's a negative liberty. We don't have many positive rights in this country. So rights of positive provision are things like voting, as we heard, fair trial, education at the state level. But all the other things we talk about as rights tend to be negative. The government may not interfere with our exercising of our liberty. And that's what this would be. So it isn't every doctor must prescribe to every patient who asks. It's not that kind of a positive provision, which I think was the way that Mark Conrad was
articulating.
Yeah, framing
it as a freedom versus a right.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And freedoms are a kind of right. They're called a negative right in philosopher's language.
We have a number of calls, as I've mentioned, and it's interesting, Jeff, I should also mention to everybody that I started getting emails about this last night. I mean, Nick, this terrific and thoughtful writer from Charles Village, sent me an email at midnight, and I got several this morning before we even went on the air. So this is obviously a topic that a lot of people have given a lot of serious thought to, and it's something that people want to engage with. Let's go to Ross in Annapolis, who's on the phone. Ross, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling. Ross, can you hear me? Okay, we'll get to Ross in a second if we can find him. How about Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania? Clarence, it's nice to hear from you, sir. Welcome back.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to make this brief. Legal matters would be an insurance company. You're using the basis of suicide. Insurance companies won't pay off on that. So how are the families running through this? I'll take my answer off the air.
I don't know what the provision in the law, whether or not even the provision in the law addresses the thing of suicide, but that is something that, a patient and the family might want to consider. I mean, if there is an insurance parameter to their decision, they may not be able to collect on the insurance if the person chooses to end his or her life under this law.
I think in the states where there is this policy that this is not an issue, and that ought not be a reason or not, right, to exercise one's decision in this area. So I think policy can be addressed to prevent that to be as being a criterion that people would use.
Let's try Ross again in Annapolis. Ross, can you hear me?
Tom, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me today. So I can provide some perspective on this in that I'm a nurse here in Annapolis, but I also lost my father last October to metastasis from lung cancer in the state of Washington. And I helped my father go through with the Death with Dignity Act for himself in Washington. And it was a difficult decision, one that we didn't arrive at easily, but because they had to do a biopsy on him to figure out the nature of his brain metastasis, rendered him paralyzed and basically destroyed his quality of life. So it was very much a quality of life issue for him. And this allowed him to, arrive at his end peacefully and, as other emailers have mentioned, with some, modicum of control over, mm-hmm. His right to self-determination.
Well, I'm so sorry for your loss, but you used the term we when you came to the determination of exercising this option. Was it a decision that was made with you and him, or you and other members of your family and your dad?
Well, so in my father's case, he had been battling lung cancer on and off with multiple recurrences of metastasis over a 5-year period. And unfortunately, many oncologists do great work, but they are also oftentimes willing to treat somebody right up until they basically have one foot in the grave. And that was the situation with my father. They wanted to keep treating him, saying they could cure the metastasis in his brain, but not acknowledging the fact that his quality of life had basically been ruined, in his opinion, due to his inability to live, you know, an independent life, move around, and not require total care. So as a nurse, I advocated on his behalf and discussed the options with him. I was very familiar with it because I was a nurse in Washington State for 6 years before moving out here. And I made him, you know, aware of what his options were and helped coordinate with the two providers required by Washington State law to help him follow through with this.
And we're so grateful that you're sharing this, you know, powerful and clearly an emotional story. Let me ask you one more question, Ross, and that is, now that you're several months after the event, your dad passed away in October, have you mm-hmm. found that your feelings about the decision have evolved? Have they changed any? Are you at peace with that decision now?
It was something that I always ethically felt was appropriate. If people don't wish to exercise it, then they certainly don't have to. The state of Washington on the death certificate does not list suicide as his cause of death, but rather his lung cancer, as I believe is appropriate. If anything, this whole experience with my father really has strengthened my belief in that right to self-determination, and I would definitely, you know, say that I'm an advocate for that choice for people.
Well, Ross, thank you very much, and our condolences to you and your family for the loss of your dad, and I very much appreciate your sharing your story. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Let's take one other call for the moment. Lily in Anne Arundel County. Lily, welcome to Midday.
Hello. I'm really just calling to take issue with something that another caller said. Mark Comrade, who I recall was a doctor at Shepherd
yes,
Pratt.
Yes, he's a psychiatrist,
A psychiatrist, yes. And he mentioned a couple things. One, he mentioned that when the government enshrines something as a right, that the government takes it upon itself to protect that right and to provide the means for us to exercise that right, which is, and he mentioned the example of voting, that the government provides voting booths for us to vote at. The obvious counterpoint to that is the freedom of speech. The government does not provide a platform for anybody to say what they want. There's no government-funded platform for anybody to stand up and say whatever they feel like saying.
Right. Well, the Constitution actually puts it in a negative light. It says the Congress shall not impede the right of people to speak.
This is freedoms versus positive provisions. Yeah.
And your other point, Lily? Mm-hmm.
My other point was that the Hippocratic Oath is more than anything an appeal to tradition, which on an ethics show should be challenged as perhaps a logical fallacy.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment. I appreciate it. So, logical fallacy. You're a philosopher and an ethicist. Jeff Kahn, what do you think?
I'm gonna respond to both callers, if I may. Mm-hmm. So let me take Ross's comments first. And I think among the compelling things that he said, in addition to sharing his story, is the notion that people can make a request for a prescription for aid in dying, but not exercise it, right? It's about the ability to have control, and palliative care can do much of the work of helping relieve people suffering at the end of life. And the experience in the states that have had this policy for now a few years largely, I think, prove that out, that people make the request for the drugs but then don't actually use them because they don't feel they need to. That's different than saying it shouldn't be permitted. And in Ross's father's case, maybe they needed to go all the way to that end. But he was really asking for the ability to control suffering and the end of life. And that's, of course, the goal of palliative care and sort of the extension of that in bills like this. The Hippocratic Oath is clearly from another era, it's ancient, right, Greece. And there is a lot of debate in the professional communities about the role of healthcare providers, not only physicians, realize, but the nurses and other healthcare professionals are quite torn about where the line ought to be for them. They don't want to see their patients suffer. That is certainly not what they signed up for. And the Hippocratic Oath doesn't demand that you stand by as a professional and watch your patient suffer It doesn't speak to that, right? And so to read one piece of that, as Mark Conrad did, out of context in 21st century medicine, right? We didn't have ventilators in ancient Greece either, or the ability to treat people past the point that they want to be treated in ancient Greece as we seem to have now. Mm-hmm. So we need to, I think about it in a more through-going, holistic way, and rather than just rely on words that were written thousands of years ago.
Got an email from Rosalind who says, I want medical aid in dying to be an option at the end of life. I am 82 years old and healthy and strong, but I know that one day I will die. I am terrified of what the end game might be for me, and you should be too. I am very much attached to my very personal body and like to be in control of it. I want to maintain that control until I take my last breath. Knowing that medical aid in dying is an option would give me the peace of mind I need. Those who oppose medical aid in dying can choose whatever they want for how they will die. So why am I not given the same dignity of personal choice over my own body? It's interesting. Jeff Kahn, is this, and Lily, or Rosalind rather, wrote a much longer email that brought up a number of other points, one of which is that people in the medical community can control this a lot more than people who aren't doctors. They can prescribe themselves pills, or they can, you know, they have options that, you know, insider options that maybe others don't. But when we talk about control of your body and choice, it's interesting how redolent this is of the abortion debate.
Yeah,
I mean, some of the questions, the ethical questions raised are quite analogous.
Well, and I would say in between those two poles, we have spent a lot of time in the 20th century and into the 21st telling people that they get to choose what will happen to them in the context of their healthcare and lots of other areas of life as well, right? So self-determination isn't something we just sort of toss out as words. We live that, certainly in the United States. We get to decide for ourselves most of the things about our lives. Anybody who's interacted with a medical system knows the feeling of not being in control, right? And I think it's a part of what needs to happen in the discussion between professionals and patients, that professionals have information and experience that patients do not. Patients feel very much out of control and at the mercy of somebody else. And Rosalind's email, I think, is evidence of wanting to take back some of that control as individuals, as we relate to medicine, healthcare, and in particular, at the end of our life. No one wants to feel out of control at the end of their life. And that's what this, I think, is largely about as a kind of philosophical argument, right? And maybe then the question is, okay, we endorse that. Self-determination is important in Western liberal democracies. How do we make sure people can exercise their self-determination? And maybe physicians are not the right people because of the kinds of conflict that Mark Conrad very well articulated. And so maybe we need another kind of professional to help people die. That's not a crazy thought. It just hasn't been something that has been picked up and exercised yet.
Before we go to a break, this law that's being considered in Annapolis is based in large measure on the Oregon law, which is the oldest one of these laws. There are seven states in the country that have it. The newest one is Hawaii. They just passed theirs in 2017. But back in 1997, so now we're talking 22 years, and they issue a report every year on the number of people who've taken advantage of the Death with Dignity Act, which is what they call it there. So as of January of this year, for 2018, 168 people had died from ingesting the prescribed medications. 11 of those people were people who had received the prescriptions in previous years. So they had waited a while. Most patients were aged 65 or older. That's 80% of them. Most had cancer, 63% of them. And during the year, two physicians were referred to the Oregon Medical Board for failure to comply with the Death with Dignity Act requirements. So there is some monitoring of this by the medical board. But the issue of coercion is something that requires a serious attention, I think. There's no doubt. Because, you know, and we'll talk about this when we come back, but who makes the decisions about what's in the best interest of a patient? Because that happens with people who aren't even dying. That happens with people who are undergoing all sorts of illnesses.
Well, and children. And I mean, there are lots of categories of people who can't decide themselves.
Yeah. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us every so often to talk about thorny thorny ethical issues like aid in dying. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. And by the way, next month, the Berman Institute is hosting a theater of war performance that is centered around end-of-life issues. Two very well-known actors, the Academy Award Best Actor nominee David Strathairn. He was in Good Night and Good Luck. And Sonia Sohn, favorite of the locals here. She was in The Wire. They're going to present staged readings of scenes from Greek drama on Saturday night, the 13th of April at the Parkway Theater here in Baltimore. It's a free event, but you do need to reserve tickets, and we've got a link to do that at WIPR.org/midday. Coming up on the other side of this quick break, we'll have more with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@WIPR.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, it's another installment of Midday on Ethics. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, who joins us regularly. There are currently seven states who have aid in dying laws. Oregon passed their law back in 1997, and as I mentioned, Hawaii passed its law in 2017. Polls do show that 6 out of 10 Marylanders favor allowing medical assistance with end of life. However, that's, of course, a poll taken when they're thinking about it in the abstract. They're not thinking about it for their own life or the life of their loved ones. So how about you? Where do you stand on this? You're welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780, our email midday@WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. So Jeff Kahn, and when it comes to coercion, Dr. Comrade mentioned, the disability community is very, very much opposed to these kinds of laws. There's a group, national group called Not Dead Yet. They sent me an email that worried about the protections against coercion of terminally ill people, and also the disparities faced by disabled people, and this whole notion of a life worth living. You know, who gets to decide that? Does the government have any role in that kind of decision? And there are racial disparities as well. Interestingly, the caucus of black legislators in Maryland generally opposed to this legislation. White legislators more in favor of it. Michelle says, one concern I have about the bill is how it impacts communities of color. Just as we have disparities in healthcare, education, finance, and sentencing, this is one more area that could lead to disparities in terms of who receives care until a natural death and who may be coerced into an assisted suicide to save money. So these are not inconsequential concerns.
By no means are they inconsequential concerns. And I would start by saying, when we start to invoke language like lives not worth living, that's reminiscent of Nazi Germany, right? Where government made decisions about whose lives were worth living or not. And that, of course, is sort of the argument about slippery slopes about who deserves to live and who not. And that's, of course, to be avoided at all costs. The notion of, I would rather than use the word coercion, pressure. We don't want people to feel pressured to make decisions that they otherwise would not. And in some sense, this is an argument about people feeling pressured, like they have to continue to receive care that they no longer want to receive. So that's another kind of pressure. The context in which all this is happening, of course, is some people feel like they're being overtreated, and others, you just made mention of disability groups and the Black Caucus in Annapolis, feel like they're under access, right? And so it kind of depends on your perspective. So we want to avail people of the opportunity to exercise their self-determination when it's appropriate, but not feel like they're being told you shouldn't live anymore and therefore you should take this dose. We want to thread that needle. And the question is whether we can do that with this policy. And frankly, it's not so much about policy, it's about practice. When the policy gets implemented, how do we make sure that we don't fall off on either direction? That's the challenge.
The notion that a physician can predict with any modicum of accuracy the number of months a person has left to live is difficult. Cheryl Glenn, who's the former chair of the Maryland Black Caucus in the House of Delegates, brought up in the debate the other day the story of Larry Young, who was a former senator in the legislature. He's now a talk show host. He was ill for many years, and then he fell into a coma. But he recovered. And Delegate Glenn said that, you know, Mr. Young probably would have asked a doctor for a lethal prescription had the option been available back when he was sick. But, of course, he recovered. And you hear stories of this all the time. It's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, it's an art, not a science, to tell somebody you've got X number of weeks or months to live.
Right. Well, and I would say in the case you just recounted, somebody who's in a coma would not be in a position to exercise their decision in this bill or any other, because that's somebody who can't decide for themselves. So this only applies to people who could decide for themselves. I'm looking at the language, actually, of what was passed by the House. And interestingly, it says a physician has determined more likely than not that the person's underlying illness will result in death within 6 months. More likely than not. That's a 50-50 proposition. Right. So that's not a very high standard. And it, I think, acknowledges the fact that this is an art, not a science. Now, that said, people have the option. Right. It doesn't mean they have to exercise the option. And people generally would exercise the option, I think the hope is, when they're suffering and when their suffering becomes too great and they don't want to live that way anymore. So, it, as you say, this is not prognosticating with any kind of certainty. And the way that it's written, it's not meant to be certain, but rather the judgment of physicians is 50-50, you're going to die within 6 months.
And for the in the case of a person who is in a coma and not making his or her own decisions, does this option become available to the people who are acting as their medical power of attorney?
No.
It does not.
It's very
Let's
clearly,
be clear about that.
That's right. And the language of the legislation is extremely clear about that. No, the individual has to be of sound mind and body and able. So not only are they not in a coma, but they have to be deemed from a psychiatric perspective able to make decisions for themselves. So that's meant to protect the kind of problems that I think people are envisioning.
I remember the celebrated case of Terry Schiavo. She's 41 years old. All of a sudden she collapses, and she spent 15 years in what they call a persistent vegetative state. And then there was a conflict between her husband and her family. Her family wanted to keep her alive. Her brother said, people had the impression that Terry was on machines. They think she was dying. She wasn't. She was breathing on her own. She was at home and being cared for 15 years. And the husband says, look, I know what her intentions were. I know what her desires were. We talked about this.
Yes.
So that's a matter of, ending any life support interventions rather than administering in a proactive way a pill that is sure to end one's life.
Correct. So the difference there, as you just put it, is withdrawal of life support versus somebody who's not on life support and able to make a decision for themselves ingesting a dose that would lead to their death.
Let's go to the phones again to Scott in Baltimore. Scott, thanks for your call.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Tom. Thank you. Dr. Tom, thank you, Tom. So I'm thinking about indoctrination and exercising the option of having the discussion with the individual who is facing death and the relief that it is to the family and primary care physician to speak broadly and openly with the individual about their end-of-life care rather than being prevented from talking about certain things. And again, not that those actions would take place of altering end-of-life care, but the openness and the relief to everyone involved to support the individual with having a broad discussion. And should it happen that the individual chooses that option, then to relieve the family, to relieve the primary care physician of certain legal consequences of engaging in those discussions or taking part in any fashion with that. So I'd appreciate your comments, Dr. Khan.
All right, thank you for that call, Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Let me take people back a few years to the arguments that surrounded what ended up being the Affordable Care Act. And you may remember during those debates,
the famous death panels.
Exactly, the famous death panels discussion, which was actually in response to a proposal that in the ACA would be a payment to physicians to talk about end-of-life decision-making, end-of-life care with their patients. So to support that, exactly as Scott is describing, which led to this backlash that we're, as the government, creating death panels to help encourage people to end their lives, which is not what it was, but that's what the rhetoric swirled and became. And of course, the shorthand that we remember is death panels, not physicians are being encouraged to talk about end-of-life decision-making with their patients. That's too many words, and it doesn't have a kind of bumper sticker sensibility about it. So I think we have had this conversation numerous times, and the ACA debate was not the first time. This goes back to Supreme Court cases, Nancy Cruzan, a very famous case in the world that I live in, which led to something called the Patient Self-Determination Act, where now when you go into a healthcare facility, you're asked whether you have a document that articulates what you want at the end of your life. The requirement is to be asked. The requirement isn't that you must execute it, but you're required to be asked so that if you do, it gets into your medical record. So this has been a long-standing, ongoing conversation, and obviously we haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. And again, this brings up the importance of everybody having a medical power of attorney appointed in case you get to the point where you're not able to do that. For example, in our family, my mom is 87 years old, and thank God she's in terrific health. I'm the executor of her will. I'm the person in charge of her finances. I already help her, you know, paying her bills and stuff. But my brother, who is a physician, he's the one who has medical power of attorney, because we all agreed that he would be best suited to understand the nuances of what was going on should she get into a situation where that was required.
And you want that person to be someone you trust to make decisions on your behalf when you're not able. But they would not be able to exercise the right to end your life in the context of the bill we're talking about. Right. So that's a really important distinction.
Charlotte sends an email. Oregon has had assisted death choice for years. The first guest, which is Dr. Comrade, gave an example of a suicidal granddaughter taking her grandmother's pills. Has there really been an increased incidence of stolen pills from someone who qualifies under the Oregon law? I don't know of anything. But that concern that Dr. Comrade gave, I think, is a legitimate one. I mean, I know of a family who had a fentanyl patch that was left in the proximity of an 18-month-old, and the 18-month-old licked it and passed away. I mean, it's a real thing.
Of course. But it's a real thing in the context of drugs being left around where people can access them. The fentanyl patch presumably was not prescribed in the context of an end-of-life decision, right? So, it's an issue that drugs being left around for people for whom they're not prescribed and they're being used is a terrible problem. That's the opioid epidemic is not largely, but partly about that. So I agree it's an issue, but I don't know that it's an issue particular to this debate.
We have an email from Joan who says, I'm emailing to say how important the End of Life Option Act will be for Maryland residents. I'm 79 years old, and I believe the act will provide choice to a dying person, and that is the ultimate civil right. People do talk about this in terms of freedom or right, but again, these issues have to do with who gets to decide what's in the best interest of a patient at any point. Because if you're dying and you really are, you know, in great deal of pain and stuff, would it be a regular impulse for a family member to say, well, gee, you know, Dad, you're not thinking right here, and talk them out of a decision or talk them into a decision? You can imagine that happening.
Sure. And we have answered that question, I think, in the affirmative sense. It's about self-determination in every other decision related to medical care. So in some sense, this is just an extension of that to the end of one's life. I mean, that's the easy way to answer the question.
Yeah, and there are no easy answers in this kind of thing, as there usually aren't when you are here, Jeff. So thank you so much for coming here. It's been a great discussion, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, he joins me regularly to help us make sense of some pressing questions in ethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Tomorrow it's midday on theater. We're going to check in with the new artistic director at Center Stage, Stephanie Ibarra, and Judy Russick will review Flyin' West, which is the new show at Baltimore's Arena Players. We want to thank Dangerously Delicious Pies for supplying lunch today. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find more information on the web at dangerouspiesvault.com. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for your tweets and your emails. Thanks for being part of our program. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.